You're listening to the Charlottesville Podcasting Network at cvillepodcast.com. Lectures, radio shows, and more are available on demand at cvillepodcast.com. Now available through email. Sign up on our homepage. I'm Dan Daniels. On Wednesday, August 12, 2009, the Senior Statesman of Virginia and the Charlottesville Senior Center co-sponsored a candidate showcase featuring the candidates for the House of Delegates seats serving the Charlottesville-Albemarle area. Candidates Rob Bell, Steve Lance, Greg Morrow, Cynthia Neff, Brandon Smith, and David Toscano spoke at the event. Our podcast is entitled Virginia House of Delegates Candidates Showcase. Following the presentation, questions were taken from the audience. Today's program was moderated by SSV board member Sue Lieberman.
Good afternoon and welcome to everybody. I know that there are a number of new folks to Charlottesville in the room today. So I've taken the liberty of taking a little bit of information off of the General Assembly website in the hopes of filling folks in on a few very basic facts. And this is also connected to the link on the House of Delegates. The General Assembly of the Commonwealth of Virginia is made up of the State Senate and the House of Delegates, whose members' chief responsibilities are to represent citizens in the formulation of public policy, enact laws of the Commonwealth, approve budget, levy taxes, elect judges, and confirm appointments made by the governor. Our guests today are running for the election to the House of Delegates. The House consists of 100 members, each representing approximately 71,000 citizens. The House has 14 standing committees, and the term of office for a member of the House is 2 years. Each member receives a salary of $17,640. This is a non-political forum, and this is as close to coming, making a political statement that I'm going to make, but the salary is not exactly a living wage. So, I'm delighted to welcome our three seated House delegates today and their challengers. We are most grateful to all of you for being here and sharing your positions with us. From the 25th District, Delegate Steve Landes and his challenger, Greg Morrow. From the 57th District, Delegate David Toscano and his challenger, Robert Brandon Smith, who prefers Brandon to Robert. And from the 58th District, Delegate Rob Bell and his challenger, Cynthia Neff. Our format today is a forum. It is not a debate. And the fundamental difference between the two is that in a forum, the audience gets to ask the questions. The forum is an opportunity for each candidate to state their positions and to answer questions from the floor. Your questions are submitted in writing and read by the moderator. That's me. The questions will be divided into categories, and there is a committee made up of senior statesman members who will, in fact, select the questions from the different categories, submit them to me, and I will then present them to the candidates. If a candidate if a particular question is directed to a specific candidate, that candidate will answer the question first, and then the other candidates will have an opportunity to respond. For both the opening and closing statements, the challenger will go first, followed by the incumbent in each district. Jim Perkins, sitting in the front row, also a senior statesman board member, is our official timekeeper. He has what I call our traffic light, which has green, yellow, and red indicators on it so that the candidates, as they speak, know where they are in their time limits. We've allotted 5 minutes for opening statements and 3 minutes for closing statements, and we'll have a full hour for questions from the floor. We will start with the opening statements from the challenger for the seat in the 58th District, Cynthia Ness. Cynthia grew up in a military family and spent her high school years in Oklahoma. While attending college and working full-time, she became involved in public service with the Flying Samaritans to provide medical care for those who could not afford it. After school, Cynthia opened a gift shop and then became an advocate for the needs of small business. She went on to work for IBM and for the next 25 years worked in a number of managerial and executive positions at IBM, including positions in sales and marketing, manufacturing, public policy, human resources, and then retired from IBM from the executive ranks. Cynthia moved to Albemarle County in 2006 to be close to her family and again turned her time and talents to public service. Currently, she serves as chair of the AIDS-HIV Service Group Board of Directors and also serves on the Advisory Council of the Legal Aid Justice Center as a court-appointed special advocate working with abused and endangered children. Cynthia volunteers for several other community organizations that help the most vulnerable members of our community. Cynthia?
That's what I wanted to ask you. Anyway, good afternoon, everyone, and thanks so much to Sue and to Peter and to Marvin for hosting this. This is really a tremendous opportunity. I'm thrilled to be here. Is the sound okay? Okay. I'm thrilled to be here to talk to you today about these important issues facing Virginia, because really there are a lot of important issues that aren't being addressed today, and that's one of the reasons that I'm running for the House of Delegates. I'm running because I think it's about time that the General Assembly started focusing on those issues that face Virginia's families instead of issues that look good on a campaign brochure. We really need our state government to get to work. But I'm not running for office because of any General Assembly failures. I'm running because I believe that my experience in business sector makes me uniquely suited to represent you during these tough economic times. I know the issues facing small businesses because I've been there. Right out of college, I opened a small business. I also know the problems that are facing large employers and their families because I've been there. As Sue said, I started with IBM over almost 30 years ago and had almost every job in the company and left as the Vice President of Human Resources. You know, many people, but just as important as knowing what the problems of business owners and their families are, it's important to be able to solve those problems. In my time at IBM, I strove to make it a great place to work. I can tell you that I'm also used to having to tackle tough problems head on. You know, you don't rise into the executive ranks at IBM without being able to balance tough objectives, which go up every year, with dwindling resources and less money. That is just kind of how things work there. But as proud as I was of the work I did at IBM, I always thought there was more to life than contributing to the bottom line of a Fortune 500 company, though I am very happy that they're still making money and I benefit from that. But so I retired. But I didn't retire down here to kick back, watch TV, and put my feet up, though my mother has often asked me, my mother who lives with me asked me, so, like, I thought you were retired. But we had a different idea. I got involved in politics. I became a district chair in the county party. I spent every weekend last year knocking on doors for Barack Obama and Tom Perriello. I also became involved with the Legal Aid Justice Center, the AIDS Services Group, which I currently chair. And probably most importantly, the thing that's touched my life the most and I've learned the most from is becoming a court-appointed advocate for abused and neglected children. If you really want to see what the kids who are most at risk in our community and who need the most help, I would encourage anyone to become a CASA volunteer. But the thing that has driven me for as long as I can remember is that it's everyone's responsibility to make the community a better place. And when you have an opportunity, you jump at it. From the time when I was a little kid and I first became a candy striper, or we called them kind of, you know, some other thing, but then I became a big sister as I got older. And again, one of the proudest moments was watching a little girl who I'd been matched with when I was 7 graduate from Berkeley many years later and watch what a difference it made. But also to most recently, I can remember, you know, after September 11th, I lived in the New York area and going down and working at Ground Zero. And not because I had to, but because I felt I should. I've always believed and have been taught that it doesn't matter how far you climb, but if you don't reach back and try to help someone behind you, then it doesn't mean a lot. So I believe that each of us has a responsibility to be practical, to be smart, but also to serve the most vulnerable members of our community, and that's what I've been doing. So many people have asked me, did you lose your mind when you decided to run for office, including some people on this stage. So they said, what possessed you to run for office? And actually, the answer is fairly simple. I want to go to Richmond because I see problems that aren't being solved, and I think I can help. What doesn't motivate me is making this a career. I don't want to be a politician. In fact, as I was trying to write this, I could almost not spell the word. You know, I don't want to be governor, attorney general, senator, congressman, or even dog catcher. We don't need more professional politicians. We don't need people who are worried about their next job and to do the right thing. What we need are citizen activists. As I've told my guys, you know, when I first came here, I took the UVA course on Thomas Jefferson, and I think the thing that really stuck with me the most is this whole thing about citizen activism, people who are invested in their community and just want to make it a better place to live. So running for office has never been some part of a grand plan, but the work I've done in both the private sector and in volunteering has led me to believe that I'm the right person in the right place for the right time, and I hope you give me that chance. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Cynthia. And now our opening statement from Rob Bell, the incumbent in the 58th District. Rob is an honors graduate of UVA and UVA Law School and has served as a state prosecutor for 5 years. He prosecuted over 2,400 cases, working with police to bring criminals to justice, and has been a staunch advocate for the protection of crime victims. An Eagle Scout, Rob was very active with the Boy Scouts and also in the public school system prior to his election to the House of Delegates in 2001. Since his election, Rob has written a number of laws that crack down on drunk drivers, and in 2005 was named Outstanding Legislator by Mothers of Drunk Driving of Virginia. He's also been deeply involved in school safety issues and in recent years has written laws to ban criminal sex offenders from school property during school hours and to require additional background checks on school personnel. In 2008, Rob participated in and helped to overhaul Virginia's mental health laws after the tragedy at Virginia Tech. Rob?
Gosh, I'm curious if there's a photo camera on that red light that we're about to see. Jim, if everybody's been following, we have photo red now in Albemarle County. It is a privilege to see you again. I've been here, I think, every year for the last 8 years. And Cynthia, Ms. Neff, and I are coming off of the county fair circuit. So if you saw us at the Albemarle County Fair, the Green County Fair, so I think I speak for both of us. We're very happy to have a roof at all. The rain is not going to chase us into the mud. And we had our first competition on Saturday night at the Green County Fair. She and I both entered a raffle for a big picture that the Historical Society was putting on for a barn. And I'm happy to say that I won. And I don't know what that means, though. I don't know if it means that I'm on a roll, and so I'm going to win the election, too, or I've used up all my good luck, and now it's over. And either way, Cynthia, we can just quit. Either way, it's going to happen. So it's an honor to represent you. I represent you down in Richmond if you live in Albemarle County, Flavanna Green, or one precinct in Orange, and it's Thomas Jefferson's old seat. I was a UVA graduate both as an undergrad and at the law school, and then worked as a prosecutor for 5 years in Orange County before being elected for the first time in 2001. And when I first was elected, most of my bills involved the sort of law enforcement issues that I had worked on as a prosecutor. And so I did work on the drunk driving laws. We increased the penalties for people that drive drunk repeatedly, drive drunk at an elevated blood alcohol level, or if you have a kid in the car, you're going to jail. Those are laws that I worked on or wrote, and I was real happy with those. We also worked on issues of domestic violence and sexual assault. We have a number of bills to help eliminate loopholes and make sure that mostly men, but the people that do that serve the penalties they deserve. And then more recently was working on school safety issues. And so in addition to the anti-bullying bill that many of you know about, we had a bill, this was prompted by a terrible incident up in a nearby school system where a sex offender dressed up as Santa Claus entered the elementary school, and it turns out it was not illegal. And this struck us all as preposterous. And so we passed a law to deny them entry onto school property during school hours unless the judge overrode it. And then last year we had the bill to have additional background checks for teachers. Now, more recently, as we've sort of gotten into my tenure, I've been able to branch out into other issues. And the issue that most recently has taken up a lot of our time are the reforms to the mental health system as a result of what happened at Tech in April of a year and a half ago. And this was a very complicated, interesting, rewarding, bipartisan effort. And I worked, Dave was on the committee with me. We worked very closely. And I think if you followed or if you read the report or followed what happened, the real tragedy about Virginia Tech is that we had him. Mr. Cho was identified as a danger to himself or others. He'd actually been before a judge. The judge had ordered him into treatment, and he just didn't go. And when he didn't go, there was no follow-up. So this was not some random out-of-the-blue event. This was somebody that the sort of the system had already identified, and it'll be a life tragedy for all of us that that system didn't follow up, that there was no follow-through. He literally slipped between the cracks, got worse and worse, and ended up killing 32 people. So the mission of our little subcommittee was to find out what went wrong, find out where the loopholes were, and then fill them, make sure it doesn't happen again. And so it was the most sweeping overhaul of the mental health system in 35 years. It was lauded by, I think, Republicans, Democrats, House, Senate. We worked closely with Governor Kane's people who were very, very helpful in making sure we got it right. Dave had several bills, I think, that were productive. I had a couple. And so in terms of the legislative accomplishments that I, when I'm done with this, will presumably go on into the future, I think that was a big one. Now, looking into this election, obviously I'm up for re-election. I hope you will consider rehiring me for the job. The biggest issue is the economy, and it's not just because of the immediate impact it has on you. We've had a foreclosure on my street, so I'm certainly aware of the problems with the economy, but also the impact it has on the budget in Richmond. Every single thing that we talk about for the rest of the 2 hours here is going to be impacted by the ability to have the tax money to pay for it. And when the economy does badly, when we're in a recession, as we are now, it also impacts the state budget. Now, the good news is that we know the steps we need to get the economy rolling again. Virginia has the number one rated business climate in the country. We're the number one pro-business state. And what that means is small entrepreneurs, the ones who create the jobs, are already coming here. And what we have to do is preserve and promote that. And so my goal for the next 2 years, if I'm reelected, is to make sure we continue to be a place where businesses can either come if they're new or expand if they're already here or survive if they're in trouble. And there's a sort of a litany of public policy positions that are involved with that. We need to maintain Virginia's right to work law. That's the law that says you don't have to be a member of a union to work. We need to make sure the card check is not passed up in Washington. We need to keep employment costs low. We need to make sure that the legal environment is one that is not one that scares businesses away. We need to keep our medical malpractice cap. All of these are things that will help keep our number one business ranking with us. We need to make sure that we keep our education. Recently rated by Education Week, the number one state in the country to raise a child. We can't rest on our laurels. We need to keep that. We need to make sure there's sufficient money for transportation. So for all these things, I hope that we can address in the next few questions. My time is up. I look forward to your questions and our answers. Thank you.
Thank you, Rob, and my apologies to both you and Cynthia for not first announcing what areas your district covers, so thank you for covering that up for me. Going on now to the 25th district, which covers parts of the counties of Albemarle, Augusta, and Rockingham, and the city of Waynesboro. We'll hear next from Greg Morrow, the challenger in the 25th district. Greg is an optometrist who practices with his wife, Cindy, in Harrisonburg. He graduated at the top of his class from the University of New England with a bachelor's degree in marine biology and then went on to a doctorate of optometry at the Southern College of Optometry in Memphis, Tennessee. Greg is also a Navy veteran with over 10 years of service, and at the end of his military career as the department head of the optometry clinic at the Naval Hospital at Cherry Point Marine Corps Air Station, Greg was awarded the prestigious Navy Marine Corps Commendation Medal for streamlining fiscal efficiencies and the clinic saving taxpayers tens of thousands of dollars. In 2006, he was awarded a Civilian Medal of Merit by the Valley Voice Reading Service for his outstanding support and contributions to Virginia's blind and visually impaired. Greg has been involved in politics for several decades and has supported candidates on both sides of the aisle. Greg?
Thank you. I'd like to thank everybody for coming here today and for the senior statesman for putting this on, but I must say something right off the bat. My wife's name is Christy, so if she finds out that I'm married to somebody named Cindy, I'm in a whole world of hurt. I get asked quite frequently, why in God's name would I ever want to run for political office? I have a successful business. I work with my wife. I've got two beautiful young kids, a 5-year-old daughter and a 2-year-old son. I have a small alpaca farm. So why would I ever want to take this on? And I think the answer is sort of simple and complicated at the same time. First, I think part of it has to do with the nature of what makes doctors doctors, which is concern and care about people. And I'm very concerned. I'm very careful and aware of our community, and I want to see it prosper. I want to see it get better, and I guess I just always have to have my hands in the middle of it, trying to make that thing a little better. And one of the things that I'm very concerned about, and particularly now we can start talking about these sort of issues, are things like, as she mentioned, that I spent actually 13 years in the Navy. And I dealt with a lot of veterans that had a lot of health care issues, particularly mental health care issues, that were being swept under the rug. I was involved in a study on Agent Orange that was involved with the Bureau of Medicine in Bethesda, Maryland. And we had a four striper, which is a captain, come down and pretty much say, you know, we're going to keep this quiet. As far as we can tell, there's no link between these issues the veterans have and Agent Orange. And I just... to me, that's just not the way you treat your veterans. You made a promise to them. And what I'm seeing now, and I know you guys are well aware of it, is that Army suicides are at an all-time high right now. Divorces among the veterans are at an all-time high. These folks coming back overseas in order to deal with the chaos and the craziness have actually joined gangs or have re-upped for another tour, which, again, is not necessarily... healthy. And you probably were aware just a couple of months ago of a young staff sergeant who shot 5 of his own comrades. He just went crazy at a mental facility, couldn't get in time. And what I would like to do is I think we blew it in Vietnam, and we cannot afford to do that again. We need to spend more time, more effort, more money in catching these folks, just like Rob mentioned, the guy from Virginia Tech that fell through the cracks. We cannot allow these folks, these servicemen and servicewomen who are coming back overseas, to fall through the cracks. And the ones that are most, and this comes from my medical background, the ones that are most in need are the least likely to go looking for it. And I would like to support, at the local level, an effort in which we get psychologists, sociologists, case managers, caseworkers, marriage therapists involved, and we bring them over here and we help them transition to a productive society. Did you know that basically 1 in 4 homeless is a veteran? That's unacceptable, folks. We owe it to them, and as an aside, I will like to go on record right now and say thank you to everybody in this room who did serve or is a spouse of someone who served. That's a big reason why I really want to get involved. Another one is just healthcare in general. I know that's a hot topic right now, but you know, for over a decade and a half, I've been dealing with patients, and I hear their horror stories every single day. I initiate a treatment, and the first thing I get is, I can't afford that medicine, or I can't come in for those follow-up tests because I have to take care of my elderly patients. And it is frustrating. And, you know, I was never trained to sit in front of a patient when they were crying and breaking down and sobbing as to how do I go about dealing with this. And so I'm very, very concerned about this, and I think that we have a great healthcare system, folks. It's not the healthcare system that's broken. It's the health insurance industry that needs to be reformed. When you look at the cost of running Medicare, 1% of its budget is what it takes to run Medicare. But you know what it costs to run Anthem? 30%. So where is that 29% going? Well, I'll tell you, it goes into CEO and executive pay, and it goes into profit sharing. In my mind, medical care is not one of those things that should be necessarily controlled by bean counters making decisions. I can't put a value on your life. I can't put a value on your life. And we need to stop that, and we need to change this and make sure that our 47 million uninsured, our 1 in 10 children here in Virginia are covered. And then lastly, I'm big into green job creation. I don't know if you're aware of this, but back in 2007, 9 million jobs were created in the green collar sector. That's $20 to $50 an hour jobs. $625 million has been dedicated to job creation, and not $1, not one job has come to Virginia. And we need to jump on this, just like we did back in the early 80s with the tech boom, and in the 90s with the dot-com boom. But we need to bring this money here because it's being spent everywhere else. Thank you.
Thank you, Greg. Now, the incumbent in the 25th district is Steve Landes. Steve received a Bachelor's of Science degree from Virginia Commonwealth University and is currently serving his seventh term in the House. He is a member of the House Education Committee, of which he is vice chair, and is also a member of the Appropriation Rules and Privileges and Elections Committee. He is the first non-attorney to serve as a member and chairman of the Virginia Code Commission and also serves on the boards of trustees of the Center for Rural Virginia and the Frontier Cultural Museum of Virginia. Steve is a member of both the American Legislative Exchange Council, I'm running into some mouthfuls here, and the National Conference of State Legislators Education Committees. He served as executive director of New Biz Virginia and the Shenandoah Valley Small Business Incubator for 5 years. Currently, Steve is the Community Relations Coordinator for DuPont Community Credit Union, headquartered in Waynesboro. Steve?
Well, thank you for that introduction. And also let me thank the senior statesman for inviting us once again for this event. And also, I want to thank Marvin. Rob and I had the opportunity to serve with Marvin when he worked in the General Assembly, and it was good to see him again, and I want to thank him for his service. And I want to thank the Senior Center for hosting this once again. This is a great facility. It's always good to come to this facility. I also don't know, Marvin mentioned a little bit about trying to get members. I'm going to be 50 this year, so I'm not sure if I'm going to qualify for the senior statesman, but I'm getting pretty close to that end of, that point where I may. So, I also want to thank Sue for being the MC. That's not an easy job. I've had to do that before, and thank you for doing that. And I also want to thank my opponent, Greg, for his service, especially in the Navy. And I think he's dead on when he says we need to thank each and every person that served in the military. My father was in World War II, had another uncle that was in World War II in the Battle of the Bulge, and another uncle who was in the Navy in World War II. So I think that service is great, and appreciate that in my family. And I thank him for his service in the Navy to our country, and thank him for that. I also want to talk a little bit about in the introduction, I guess the 5 minutes we've got, one of the reasons I'm running for re-election. My parents, when I was growing up, taught me at an early age that you shouldn't just be taking from society, you shouldn't just be taking from what benefits and blessings we have in this part of the Commonwealth and in Virginia and the United States, but you ought to give something back. And I've always looked at my service in the General Assembly as my way to give back. I didn't have the opportunity to serve in the military, but this is my way of giving something back to the communities that I serve. And having worked in the General Assembly in some form or fashion, either as a staff person or for Congressman Goodlatte for 2 years, or as a member of the House for the last 13 years, it's been an honor and a privilege and a way for me to give something back to the community and the communities that I've had the honor of representing. The precincts in Albemarle that are part of the 25th District, I don't know, I want to mention that because those of you that may be here from the 25th House District are Crozet, Brownsville, and Yellow Mountain. So if you live in those areas, the 25th House District, and I'm your current representative. Let me talk real quickly about some of the legislation that I've been involved in, as Rob mentioned as well. That I've had the honor and privilege of working on. One that I was able to complete during the last 2 years, working with the Farm Bureau, Chesapeake Bay Foundation, with Soil and Water Conservation Districts, has been the Natural Resources Commitment Fund. We've been able to fund and provide funding for best management practices in a cost share program where farmers put money and the state puts money in, working with local soil and water conservation districts, to clean up and protect our streams and waterways, and to, in turn, clean up the Chesapeake Bay. And why is that important to Albemarle or Augusta? One, because we all live on this planet. We all live in this this Commonwealth of Virginia, and it's our duty to try to protect the natural resources we have so that we have them for the future. I've got a 7-year-old, and I want him to be able to live here and take advantage of the natural resources that we have for the future, and the rest of the citizens, obviously, that live in this area. I was able to support and sponsor legislation that has set up a program to donate unused drugs that can go to free clinics. That's important because, as has already been mentioned, health care is an issue. We need to do something now to try to alleviate the costs. At the state level, we're somewhat limited, but there are things we can do. And one of the things that I've worked the last 2 years is to try to set up that program, get it in place, and we hope that that'll be up and running next year, working with the Board of Pharmacy and others and the free clinics around the Commonwealth of Virginia. I also have had the chance to introduce legislation related to long-term care and encouraging individuals to take advantage of long-term care. People my age need to plan and prepare for either assisted living, nursing care, more importantly, to be able to stay at home if we can do that. That's the best place for individuals. People do much better at home. And then last but not least, I want to talk a little bit about the things that I think are important this year. Jobs is the most important issue that I've heard from citizens and has been since I've been in the General Assembly. It was the first time I ran in 1995, and it's a top issue again this year. We've had over 5,000 jobs created in the 25th District since I have been in the legislature, but that only accounts for a portion. It doesn't count for retail. It doesn't account for some of the agriculture jobs, so that's something. Education and health care are going to be another one that I think we need to work on in the next session. I, too, would like to ask for your support and help for re-election. I hope you would see fit to rehire me for the next 2 years. It's been an honor and privilege to serve, and I look forward to doing that again if given that privilege.
Thank you, Steve. Now on to the 57th House District, which includes parts of Albemarle County and the city of Charlottesville. R. Brandon Smith is the challenger in the 57th. He prefers to be called Brandon rather than Robert, which is his first given name. Forgive me for even mentioning it, Brandon. Brandon's a Virginian by birth. He attended Princess Anne High School in Alexandria and is a member of the graduating class of 1965, was awarded the Time Magazine Certificate of Excellence for his knowledge of current events and world affairs. He attended Randolph-Macon College, studied history, and played lacrosse. Brandon lived in Richmond for 25 years and is a founding member of Cornucopia Natural Foods Company in Richmond and convened Richmond Greens in 1989, leading the same Greens in a successful fight against a proposed medical waste incinerator for New York State. Brandon has resided in Charlottesville and Nelson County since 1994. He's a longtime citizen advocate volunteer an environmentalist, a history preservationist, and has advocated for bike lanes and living wages in Charlottesville. He currently serves on the Population and Ethics Committee of the Thomas Jefferson Planning District Sustainability Council. A carpenter and drywall mechanic by trade, Brandon offers a quote by John Randolph of Roanoke when asked, "My country, sir? My country is Virginia." Brandon?
Bear with me, please. I'm used to, when I speak at these forums, usually standing in the back and directing my remarks to the front. And so it's a little more awkward up here. I think I'll catch on. I've managed to catch on most of my life eventually. I'm delighted to be here. It's a very distinguished group I'm up here with. I noticed that the three of us challengers have a military connection. I am a Marine Corps brat. I was raised in the Marine Corps, grew up in it, more or less grew up in it. And if you're familiar with that, I have to agree, my previous speaker mentioned the Vietnam War. I dodged that one myself. Luckily and regretfully, because I had a physical deferment, but we are still dealing with the fallout from that war in society. And my father in particular, I want to mention this before I forget, and my mother, my father was a Marine Corps officer and served in Vietnam, amongst other things. But actually, I assisted planting roses out here 10 or 12 years ago, out front. So that when I come here and come by here, I'm reminded of that. And I emphasize that because I want to second what I'm hearing from the other candidates up here, that that public service it was explained by my father, to quoting MacArthur, it's duty, honor, country in the Marine Corps. And is actually, in the Marine Corps, you're taught that it's not an option. It is your duty. So that makes it easier for somebody like me. But I want to read something. This is wonderful. I had Chinese before I came. And my fortune cookie says, "Do not worry about holding a high position. Worry rather about playing your proper role." This is a marvelous fortune, I think. And it's up there with the one that my favorite of all time, but this may supplant it, was, "Plan to be spontaneous tomorrow." I'm running partially because I've always wanted to, partially because I could use the job, partially because I'm dissatisfied with the status quo in American society, and have been. I've been a malcontent most of my life. I think Americans generally, because of the frontier mentality, and best expressed by the Reverend Ben Campbell in Richmond, what we're really good at is getting in our cars and driving away from the problems that we don't want to think about. And the problem is motivating me to run, and I hope to address the most and impact the most, is the Meadow Creek Parkway proposition. I'm running as someone who for 15 years or more has generally operated with Democrats, but I've been splitting my ticket forever. I've been supporting Virgil Goode for years. And I'm baffled as a loyal Democrat from time to time, and perhaps no longer. I'm running as an independent, I want to clarify that. And I'm running as a Green. But the Meadow Creek Parkway is an item that just baffles me. It doesn't make any sense on all kinds of levels. And particularly, I want to clarify something. I was really privileged to be on that Population Ethics Committee, but that's something that ended a number of years ago, that service. And what we have here, this page here is the 10 accords, sustainability accords, that beginning with retaining the natural habitat. These are guidelines for our policymakers in the counties and the city for dealing with issues that are affected. And I can't find for the life of me where this Meadow Creek Parkway, which is a shortcut for suburban drivers, makes any sense. But I don't intend to dwell on that because I've got a number of really controversial items, and I hope you'll bear with me. How many? One more minute? 45 seconds. My table's over there. I have no literature, but I have some books you're welcome to look at. I think the most significant thing I should say is I'll trot out the most controversial items I can think of. I want to demolish Garrett Square, the housing project. And I refer you all to Michael Paul Williams, or the black columnist for the Times-Dispatch, his article on the subject of a few years ago. Public projects have been one of the most significant failures in American public policy in the 20th century. And the solution, the remedy, not a solution, is to demolish those projects, which are a suburban model anyway, and create a ring of housing around the perimeter of the city. In other words, break up the problem and their problems. I could sit here for hours and talk about the problems in the projects. Unfortunately, I've run out of time. But my other, I think, most controversial item, and I want to get this out, is I want to outlaw and abolish homework forever in the public schools. And I'm very serious. I want kids to be reading. I don't want them even to take their books home. No book bags, no nothing. I want them to go home and read.
Thank you, Brandon, and so do the kids. The district incumbent is Democrat David Toscano. David was elected to his first term in the Virginia House of Delegates in November 2005. He was born in Syracuse, New York, and was educated in the Syracuse public school system, and then received a bachelor's degree from Colgate University, a PhD from Boston University, and a law degree from UVA. He has taught at various schools and universities, and when he's not in the House or doing House business, is a practicing attorney specializing in family law and real estate. David served on the Charlottesville City Council from 1990 to 2002, and served as the mayor from 1994 to 1996. He serves on the Courts of Justice, Transportation, and Science and Technology committees in the House. He's also a member of the Disability Commission, the Joint Commission to Study Math, Science, and Technology in Education in the Commonwealth, and the Joint Subcommittee to Study Land Use Tools in the Commonwealth. David serves on the United Way Board, and is a member of the Charlottesville Regional Chamber of Commerce. David?
Thank you. Thank you very much. It's great to be back again. I think this may be the biggest crowd we've had here, and must be the distinguished challengers here that are bringing all you out today. It's certainly not the incumbents, right? This is a great opportunity for me to reintroduce myself. That's partly what elections are about, reintroducing yourself to the public, trying to hear what the public thinks about the critical issues of the day, and trying to give some insight about what our priorities are as people who offer themselves for public service in the coming years. So let me start a little bit. Sue talked a little bit about me growing up in Syracuse, New York, going to the public schools. I was the first of five kids, and I was the first in my household to go on to college and graduate from college. And as you can see, I spent a lot of time in school. Hopefully I've served as a good example for other people in my family to go on to school. And hopefully my son will follow my footsteps and go on to school. As some of you know, I have a wonderful 11-year-old son who is frequently seen on the stage, and hopefully some of you saw him in Oliver or Camelot or whatever this summer. But he's a joy. And I've been married to the same woman for 32 years. That's pretty good, I think. She actually grew up in Charlottesville, and she can tell you stories where she used to ride on the lap of her father and drive the car out 29 right out here before there was a here. And so she's got some stories. When I was growing up, my father ran a men's clothing store and tuxedo rental shop. And for the longest time, when we were on these stages, I used to go around looking at men and guessing their suit sizes. I think I've lost some of that skill, but I can tell you this. It is pretty difficult to tie your own bow tie, and I think we have to compliment Brandon for being able to do that. We'll get into guessing the sizes later on, and I only do men. You know, seriously, it's been an honor to be serving this community for the last 16 years. You know, I served 12 years in local government and the last almost 4 years now in the General Assembly. And I've represented a great community. I mean, just look around this place and travel throughout the Commonwealth of Virginia, and you realize what a special place we have here, a vibrant economy, a cosmopolitan central city, wonderful rural landscapes, a great public school divisions, a university that it is a top public university in the country, a wonderful community college here. And we've got so many people who work very hard to try to ensure that their families are protected and there's food on the table every night. And at the same time, they figure out a way to give back to the community in so many ways so that our volunteer rate in this community is exemplary and really is the envy of many, many places throughout this Commonwealth. I've learned a lot during my time in the General Assembly. If you take a look at my record, you will see that I have tried to figure out ways where I can work in a bipartisan way to get things done. If you look at some of the things that I've worked very hard on in the years I've been in the General Assembly, you would see foster care legislation, adoption legislation. These are things that go past the partisan divide that sometimes infects the General Assembly and that we need to get through. Beyond that, you know, I'm willing to tackle some of the really big issues, too. I've had a number of energy bills introduced and a number of them passed in the last several years. Those aren't always easy to get passed because there are a lot of folks out there who just as soon see things stay the way they are, not recognizing that the whole world is changing. And if we don't figure out a way that we can change in advance of the world changing, we have the potential to be left behind. We have a great country. We have great people in it who can be on the cutting edge of the future, and we need to make sure that our legislature is anticipating the trends and passing legislation and putting the dollars in place to take advantage of what the future may bring. The future for this year is all about the economy. But that doesn't mean we can't keep trying to address these critical challenges. We've got huge problems in our public school system. We need to make sure we have adequate funding to solve those problems, whether it's teacher salaries or resources in the classroom. We need to make sure that the social safety net remains in place for those people who are most affected by this economy until we come out of it. And rest assured, we will come out of it. Rest assured, we intend to put Virginia in a place that when we do come out of it, we are stronger than any state in the country. I thank you for the opportunity to serve you. I look forward to hearing your questions and your comments.
Thank you all. Okay, now we'll go on to our questions from the audience. I will read the question and direct it to a specific candidate whose name may be indicated on the card. After the candidate has responded to the question, the other candidates will also have another opportunity to respond. Where there is no name on a question, we'll do it on a first-come, first-served basis. So the questions are up for grabs for anybody. Okay, question number one is not directed to a particular candidate, and it reads, what is your position on drilling off the shores of Virginia? Who would like to tackle that one first? Cynthia.
I think it's a great question. I think everybody's kind of worried about energy. It's clearly one of the things that I'm worried about, and I think that we have a tremendous opportunity to be a leader in the energy economy. I don't believe in drilling offshore because I'm very concerned until we absolutely have the high energy efficiency targets that I think are necessary to drive not only business in that area, but also a cleaner environment. Until we're using renewable energy credits to their maximum efficiency, I don't think we can justify drilling offshore.
Okay. I'd say absolutely whatsoever. And I think conservation would be in order. That remains to be tried. I think while I'm on the subject, I might as well suggest that I'm against nuclear power retroactively, not even forward. And I would also like to mention, I think we have a lot of rivers in Virginia, and I think we could do very effectively small-scale hydroelectric power stations. As I recall, Richmond, the city, has its own hydroelectric generator electric service that they pull right out of the James River, and it's not a very large plant.
Anyone else have an opinion? Bob?
Yeah, I'm in favor of offshore drilling, and I think we need to be part of an overall comprehensive... is it cold for anybody else?
Yeah.
Okay. Talking about energy makes this especially appropriate. I don't know if there's somebody who... What I was going to say is I think it would make sense to make it part of a comprehensive energy strategy that we are importing energy into Virginia. We have resources both in terms of offshore. We have coal. We have the Dominion Power Plant at Lake Anna, which is going to be the next likely nuclear online site. I think that it's been 30 years since Three Mile Island. I think it's time to look at that again. I do think we need to take up conservation. We had a neat bill this year. It wasn't mine, so we can give credit to Al Pollard. But his bill was, he said, we give all these financial credits for energy companies that develop new sources. Why not also give them the same incentives for conservation? I think that's a great idea. And so I think that if you add these different approaches together, see which ones are most cost effective and go forward. But I absolutely think it's something we should put on the table. Thank you.
Yeah. I want to follow up by saying that I agree that we've got to have an overall comprehensive strategy. The fact is, we're going to have to do everything to meet the need that is out there currently and in the future, not only for the Commonwealth of Virginia, but the United States. So we've got to look at nuclear. We've got to look at offshore drilling. But it's not just oil that they need to look for. It's natural gas. That would be a great benefit to the Commonwealth. In fact, we could use those resources to reinvest into the Commonwealth of Virginia if we had those royalties, similar to what Alaska is able to do with their oil exploration. We also have to provide incentives when they're appropriate and when they're market-based. Sometimes we have proposals that come forward that even in economic tough times should be moved forward, but we've got to make sure it makes sense. The market has got to have the research and development going on. The private sector has to be willing to make the investment for those kinds of new alternatives to work. And you're starting to see that in the automobile industry. You're going to see that, I know, with Dominion. They're looking at wind power and all sorts of other alternatives, but it's going to take everything.
Great. Yeah. Greg?
I would just like to mention I'm actually against offshore drilling, and here's the reason why. The media and the parties in and on themselves like to think that these things, conservation and alternative energy and fossil fuels, are mutually exclusive, and they're not. I think most intelligent people, I think every specialist agrees that there's a finite amount of oil and gas out there, and we need to be planning for the future, and our politicians haven't been doing that. And I look at the next 10 to 20 years as a transition phase where we are transitioning out of fossil fuel and into alternatives. Europe's already gone that way. Europe is really big into solar, and they're designing these wonderful things that are solar farms that are actually literally powering 100,000 person cities. They've got windmill generators off of the coast of Holland that are powering towns of 5,000 and 10,000 people. We in the United States produce 2/3 of all of the windmills that are used in the world. Do we use them? No. They're all going overseas. But the latest data that I had heard is that if we tap the oil off the coast of Virginia, it's going to take almost a decade before it reaches our gas tank. Again, that's the stopgap measure, and where does that help us? It's going to take that long to develop, process, build those big facilities, which, by the way, are in the largest naval training ground in the world. But also, by then, they've already determined, the geology has already determined that there's a finite amount there that's not going to last more than probably 30 years. So, you know, we can nitpick all this that we want, but we need to be talking about where we're going to go past that. Talk about drilling here and drilling there is fine, and we need to do that. We need to look at nuclear power. We need to look at clean coal technology. I'm not disagreeing with that. But if we aren't forward enough thinking to see what my children and grandchildren are going to be needing to do for these energy demands, then we're letting them down. And that's where I want to go.
Thank you.
Do we all get to weigh in on this question? I mean, I think we do have to have a comprehensive energy program. And I think that, you know, I think people get, they become wedded to this notion of offshore drilling. It's almost like a symbol. But really, if you start to untangle it and start to ask some questions, you got to ask, how much can we reasonably expect to produce? When is it going to be produced? What benefit do we derive from its production? And how do we help provide incentives for it to be done if we conclude it's in our interest? Some of the questions that got raised here are very legitimate questions. No one is quite sure how much is out there. There could be a relatively small amount. It could be a large amount. Beyond that, it is located in the naval training grounds. So there's some pretty big concerns about that on national security grounds. We get more bang for the buck quicker through a couple of things. One is efficiency. The American Council on Energy Efficient Future, which is a nonpartisan group formed by engineers and policymakers, has concluded that energy efficiency, if really, really pushed, would help obviate the need for many, many new coal-fired plants being built in this country. So if we can push that envelope, we create the possibilities to limit the need for some of these polluting sources and some of these sources that are very, very speculative. I think that the General Assembly is now starting to recognize the need to plan for a new energy future, and you've seen a lot of bills last year, and you'll see more bills this year designed to do that, and hopefully we'll get some of that done.
Thank you, David. As long as we're on the subject, we have another question here that asks, uranium has been found in Chatham, Virginia, in the Chatham, Virginia area. Are you for or against drilling for it? And this is also addressed to all parties. Okay. If anyone wants to respond to that, or even a ditto.
There is a study that's ongoing by the Coal Commission, I think it's the Coal Commission, or the Coal and Energy Commission, to determine whether it's safe to mine it. And there are a lot of people who have very strong concerns that it really isn't safe the way the climate is in Virginia and the geography in Virginia. And I think it's safe to say that we need to see what the study says. I think, you know, until it can be proven to be safe, I don't support it. But it may be that the study will come forward with a different result, and I think we'd have to look at it at that point in time.
This is an example of what sometimes happens in Richmond. The argument was over whether to have a study about having a study about the actual. I'm serious. This is Dave just said is actually puts him on the, I don't want to mess you up here, Dave, but the pro-uranium side of that particular argument, only because he's willing to actually look at it. I think that this is something that needs a study. I mean, it's the amount that's there, the benefit of taking it out, and the costs and concerns that people are raising is certainly something that somebody who's an expert at it rather than the six of us should be looking at before we make any decisions, I think.
Rob and David are exactly right. The study went through the Rules Committee that I actually serve on, and the scientific aspect of whether it's harmful or not will come out, because there are going to be some scientists and individuals involved, and that's what we should be doing. I will say that we have a nuclear engineering program at Virginia Commonwealth University, my alma mater, and UVA used to have a nuclear program. We're looking at the state and looking at that as a possibility for Dominion Power and other electric generation utilities across the country, because nuclear is one of those things that has to be looked at. Now, whether we mine uranium from Virginia or not, this study will determine if it's safe or not. But I do think that is, again, as I mentioned earlier, one of those alternatives that we are going to have to look at from the standpoint of energy sources.
Years ago, when I was an engineering physics student, I actually worked at a nuclear power plant in the summertime. And it's amazing how clean it can be and the great potential. The problem is, as we've seen in Chernobyl and in Three Mile Island, is you've got the human element. And so there's where it bears some fruit. But I think a cautious approach is absolutely the way to go, and leaving all of these options on the table. One of my concerns has been, and if you're familiar with this, the uranium mines in the southwest of the United States and what's happened to those towns and those people. They pretty much targeted Native Americans to be the ones to be the miners, and they've pretty much all been wiped out. All have died of very serious health conditions that are linked directly to the mining operation. So once this study comes back, I mean, it says we can move forward, I hope to God that we have 60 years of experience that we can lean on to make sure it's a safe endeavor and protect, as Steve mentioned earlier, our responsibility to protect our rivers and water table.
So it looks like everybody's trying to answer, so I'll try to add something. Again, and I think my point was with everybody else's concern about uranium. Uranium is a very risky element, and until it's absolutely perfectly safe, I think that there are just other things we can do. My personal frustration is you hear people talking about, green energy jobs and how we can do that. And I'm worried that the state should be really focused on things that are more of a sure thing. Energy efficiency. You know, we don't have mandatory high targets for energy efficiency in this state. We don't have mandatory renewable energy credits. What kind of energy companies are we going to draw to this state to really try to participate in the new energy economy until we've really exploited those things that are our fingertips today and we could decide to do, and I think it would move us forward in the right direction.
I'd like to add something. I want to clarify something. The last couple of years, I have not owned an automobile, and I really, I'm healthier, and I feel pretty good. It's a good feeling not to be involved in polluting the environment. It strikes me that when we're in a war overseas, over energy. Fossil fuels, and it's our rate, our profligate juvenile rate of consumption in this country, and that's what it is. There's no other real honest way to put it. I mean, the typical American seems to have an idea that they're entitled to just drive as much as they can and to hell with the consequences. But it strikes me that we ought to be looking at this the other way around, that the energy companies ought to be paying the Commonwealth up front. And instead of the incentives going to them for the opportunity to license and produce in the Commonwealth, and I think what I'm suggesting is that people ought to give that a little bit of consideration when they think in terms of this problem. And instead of I want to point out something that's in my literature. And it's a line from the Iroquois, and where they looked at decisions and they considered what the impact would be on the seventh generation.
Okay, thank you all. This question is directed to Mrs. Cynthia Neff. What is your assessment of the need for more and better jobs in Central Virginia, and what would you do as a legislator to improve the situation?
Twitch my nose. No. Just trying to be a little... This is such a serious crowd.
That works, you can have a job.
You heard it here. I think, you know, we need better jobs here. I'm very concerned. Does everybody here know what the top five jobs in Virginia are? Retail, office clerk, waitress, food prep, and janitor. And I think that that's problematic. I think we need jobs that people can support their families on. And I think, you know, everybody's trying to work for that. But I think, you know, it's one of the reasons why I've made education one of the fundamental, you know, issues of my campaign is because, you know, I've hired thousands of people around the world, and it's about skills. And if we don't have the folks that have the skills, we're not going to attract the jobs to hire the people. And so that's why I think education is really important. I think that there's, you know, as we just talked about it a minute ago, about, you know, to enter into the energy economy. If we just did a couple things pretty quickly, I think we could start, you know, demonstrate our seriousness. I was at a little company called Alt Energy a couple weeks ago. You know, there's some sexy stuff going on in alternative energy, and that we can really bring those kind of jobs into Central Virginia and become known for that. But the other thing is that if you look like at a little state down the road from us called North Carolina, they have obviously had a maniacal focus on bringing jobs there. I know I worked for one that was lured to Research Triangle Park. We continue to lose jobs to them. We need to have the same arsenal of tools to bring these kind of jobs into Virginia so that our folks, our family, our kids can get jobs, that they can raise families, and we can pay more taxes. At the end of the day, we want everybody to be able to pay more taxes because they're making money. You know, it's that's kind of the American way. But I think that, you know, this state can do a lot more. Thank you.
Go by without being able to comment on it.
Absolutely not.
I mean, if you look at this area, we are in a unique position, really primarily because of the university. But, you know, if you look at our unemployment rate, it's always below the state average. And, of course, the state average is always below the national average. And that's what's wonderful about living in this region and wonderful about living in Virginia. But we can't rest on our laurels, and there are decisions that are made at the state level that have a critical impact. For example, if we don't continue to adequately fund the University of Virginia, adequately invest in the capital projects that are here at the university, adequately provide funding from the state government that will help build our infrastructure for this university and encourage commercialization of ideas out of this university, then we run the risk of not fueling the fire that will allow more jobs to be created in this community. And let me tell you a little story because of how the General Assembly works and what you got to be careful about. Last year we had a little bill. Well, I thought it was a little bill. It was a little bill designed to encourage more scientific research in the Commonwealth and encourage more job growth in that industry, which creates good jobs that pay a lot of money and that would help various parts of the Commonwealth. Well, that little bill got hung up, and it got hung up on an idea called stem cell research, which a group in the General Assembly didn't particularly like. And they tried to torpedo the bill, even though the bill had almost nothing to do with stem cell research, because of an agenda that they were trying to push. That kind of approach is not going to work if we're going to keep Virginia competitive and if we're going to really invest in the kinds of research that we need to have in Virginia and the kind of university support that we need to have in Virginia so that we can stay on the cutting edge. So watch out for that stuff because it happens all the time. But I think that's the key to us creating new jobs in this community that pay good wages is the university.
Mr. Mike Mann, thank you. The job creation issue is a multi-level issue, and the first one is absolutely education, and it starts in kindergarten. But In this Recovery Act, there was $125 million was passed by President Bush in 2007 towards education for green jobs, green collar jobs. And then an extra $500 million was added in the Recovery Act. Now, green collar jobs are jobs that actually apply to anything in alternative fuels or in passive weatherization or in anything that is actually fuel efficient. Now, there's over 250 of these jobs that have already been identified. About 80 of them, you need to be have a four-year degree, an engineer of some sort, solar engineer perhaps. About 80 of these jobs, you just need to have a tech degree, which is perfect, fits right in with Blue Ridge Community College, which is in our district. And also about 80 of them or so are just out of high school. They're plumbers and they're electricians and they're folks that it's exactly what they're doing now. They're just going to be working on a different piece of equipment. And these jobs are out there. This is being done in Arizona, in Texas, and in Oklahoma, and in Ohio, but it's not being done here. This is job opportunity. This is where the next manufacturing sector is coming from, folks. This is a chance, again, for us to stop exporting our jobs and start exporting products, exporting these solar panels, these wind farms. But to do that, particularly here in Virginia, you've got to create the environment. You've got to get the universities involved. You've got to get these great minds who are inventing these things to be able to get their patents passed here in Virginia. It's almost impossible for somebody to get a patent passed here. We need to break down those barriers. We need to do tax incentives. Creed Eads put forth a bill in this last session that would have brought businesses here. If you are willing to invest $50 million and hire at least 200 people, 200 people is a lot of folks, a lot of employees, then they would have gotten tax incentives to be here. We would have been a flagship. You know, when you want to open a tech business, you think, okay, I've got to go to Silicon Valley. Well, what we want is when you want to own a green company, you want to own an alternative fuel company. Oh, you know what? I got to go to Virginia. And that's what we need to be working at, folks.
Thank you. Rob?
Yeah, I'd like to sort of just underline for everybody, the vast majority of the jobs that are going to be created, even in our community, are going to be in the private sector. And so we really, really need to be careful to preserve and promote this number one business ranking. And I keep bringing that back because the entrepreneurs now, we're not just competing with North Carolina and California and Oregon. We're also competing worldwide. We have to be competitive. We have to be attractive to companies that are here so they don't move. And we have to be attractive when a company's looking for a place to headquarter that they come here. We've had some good luck with headquarters coming here. We've got some sort of exciting new developments. Rolls-Royce is supposed to be coming with a big plant. We are hopeful that if we keep that, again, right to work, keep our legal environment friendly, keep the insurance costs down through medical malpractice caps, if we can keep those in place, we are more attractive as a commonwealth. Now, unique to our area, of course, is we have the UVA engine in the economy also, and I think it's very important that we make sure that UVA have the sort of the capital needs that it has. They've discovered that in terms of recruiting top-notch researchers, which is what you need, the tentpole researcher comes in and he brings in all the other people with him and all the research dollars, they need facilities. And they've kind of danced around. They thought it was salaries for a while. That's part of it. But really what these guys that can go anywhere want is a chance to really do first-rate research and to bring their team with them. So we've been looking at ways to make sure we have enough. You all voted for it, but the bond package to make sure they can get the buildings that they need. We had a bill that I liked. It was one of my bills. It wasn't one of my ideas, but it was brought to me. The Tobacco Commission was looking for ways to have longer-term impact with the Tobacco Commission money. They've been spending it on small projects along the way, but they said, we would like to have research into alternate fuels so long as it relates back to jobs. So this is not the kind of research that goes into a book. This would be the research that actually helps them build a facility in Southside. I thought that was a neat idea. It got through the House. It did not get through the Senate. Those are the kind of things I think we need to look at in our community in terms of specific to our area. Bring jobs here. There's been a steady hemorrhaging of private sector jobs in our community over the last decade. Many of the big employers have left or downsized. They have not been replaced. And so we have this separation between people with terrific sort of university-focused jobs and then the much less privileged service sector. I think we need to have jobs in the middle where people can get jobs in our community. Thank you.
Let me just add a couple things real quickly from my perspective. I don't think any of us disagree that we want to have jobs and we want high-paying jobs and good jobs. But government does not create jobs in and of itself. Government provides
for incentives where they're appropriate, where they make sense. But folks, in the Commonwealth of Virginia, the way economic development works is it's locally driven with the state assistance and with the administration and local legislators and local government officials trying to work to recruit those kinds of things, that the type of jobs that fit for those localities. I spent 2 years chairing the Rural Prosperity Commission, looking at specifically what's appropriate for rural Virginia. What we found is in most localities, the urban centers as well as the rural areas, is they want to be able to control not what Richmond tells them they need to do or not what Washington's telling them, but how they can empower themselves through the appropriate incentives that are market-based, that we know where investments are coming from the private sector, with government assistance, whether it's the Governor's Opportunity Fund or other funds we set up, and work at creating jobs that way. It's not easy, and it doesn't happen overnight. We worked in the Shenandoah Valley as an example, the local delegation, for about 5 years to get a higher tech research related firm in the valley. UVA is very lucky. They've got the Fontaine Research Park and those kinds of commercializations coming from research happening. But we didn't have that in the Shenandoah Valley. So we worked to get SRI International, working with Delegate Matt Lohr, myself, Senator Hanger, others. And what that is going to do is provide the start so that my son, Greg's children, other people in the Shenandoah Valley, their children and grandchildren, are going to have those kind of high-paying jobs. But that took 5 years. So it's an ongoing process. The government needs to be there and play a role. But the localities and the people in those areas have to control what they want. What people in Albemarle and Western Albemarle is not the same thing that people in the Shenandoah Valley necessarily want. And we need to allow localities of flexibility and working in Richmond to provide those appropriate incentives. And we can't forget small business. Small businesses provide the largest number of jobs and employ the largest number of people in the United States. And we've got to work not only to try to get the larger manufacturing facilities, high-tech research firms, and those kinds of things, but to help the mom-and-pop shops that are doing the work every day, whether they're retail, whether they're a shop on Main Street, and make sure those jobs are there for people as well, because that's where we have a lot of growth and a lot of economic activity here in the Valley, in the Piedmont area, and in Virginia.
Thank you. Brandon?
I guess it was about 2000, just before the can people hear me? Am I coming through?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Before the 9/11, before the bombing, I happened to read one day that the AAA said that the average operating cost for an automobile in the United States, the average operating cost for a year was $6,000 per automobile. And I would assume it costs more. I would suggest, and I've given a lot of thought to this myself, and I've lived it, that we are in the process, like it or not, of divorcing or actually just leaving behind the automobile culture. And it's a good thing, because when we have a lot of lower paying jobs, when people are trying to make a living, get to work, and paying anywhere near up to $6,000 or $7,000, whatever it is, it doesn't work. It's sort of Promethean or whatever. I get these things mixed up. I also want to point out that it's a bit ingenuous in Virginia to ignore the fact that it's been the expansion of the federal government, the defense establishment, and interstate highways, and grants for research that have basically paid the bills and made a lot of people rich, and that are people that feed at the upper half of the trough, above the salt, as somebody used to say. So I'm a little bit ambivalent in some ways about the notion that there is a need for government to even be involved in economic in providing jobs or troubleshooting jobs. I also think that communities can do an awful lot within within a given community. And one thing I'd like to see specifically is the trains throughout Virginia be reestablished to what they were. And I think the process would provide a lot of jobs.
Thank you, Brent. This question is directed to everyone, no one in particular. Do you believe in some same-sex marriages? Would you change the Virginia Constitution?
I do believe in same-sex marriages. I have, you know, lived in many parts of the country. I have lived in many parts of the world. And it seems to me when two people come together and try to build a family, there can't be a lot wrong with that. I've also worked in a company that embraced diversity, something that I think is a trait and a value system. You know, we are better with all of us than we are with just some of us. In a work environment, I've had the opportunity to see what happens to people when they can bring their whole selves to work. People are much more productive. Companies are much more efficient. You know, we make more money. I believe it's kind of core to what we do. I can tell you why diversity works in for hours if we want to kind of step aside afterwards. But I think I also believe, and I learned a long time ago when I was very young from someone who was gay, no one chooses to be a member of the most despised minority on the planet. And I don't think people choose to be gay. And I think that gay people's love is as valuable as anybody else's.
Answer this question.
Sure.
Go ahead.
I have mixed feelings about this subject too, but I'm going to take a risk here and jeopardize my standing as an honorary lesbian. I'm very serious. When I lived in Richmond, and I have lots of friends in the gay and lesbian community.
I got one left.
Okay. Over the years, and I've observed a handful of happy families that were gay or lesbian, and I've in my lifetime observed and witnessed a handful of heterosexual families that were happy and content, and that's all. So to me, the question is, why would gay people want to mimic something which is obviously, if people are going to really tell the truth, Not that great a thing. And as a matter of fact, I'm reminded, I believe Jesus Christ himself turned his back on his family of origin at one time and said, these people, and he went and stood over and went and hung out with the other people and said, these are my family. And he meant in a very inclusive way. So I'm concerned because I feel that they're in American society in the last 60 years that I've been semi-present, at least, that I've seen that people raise certain issues because they can, and they enjoy making other people uncomfortable. And this is one of those issues. And I think part of me says I regret that people say, and the gays insist that they have to call it marriage. I fully and totally support every civil opportunity that any gay or lesbian person would want. And in effect, I support the principle, but I feel it's incumbent on somebody to speak up and address. And this is a good time for me to quote my hero George Orwell, that said it's the duty of each generation to restate the obvious. And I think it's my turn to restate the obvious here. So I think that this is an inalienable right, and I regret actually the state and the churches even stick their noses in it.
I assume everybody's going to get an opportunity to comment on this one, so I will comment. I clearly have a record And I've had the opportunity to vote on the so-called marriage amendment that passed a number of times while I've been in the General Assembly. I voted against that marriage amendment that I don't know how many times in General Assembly I did that. Then I voted against it again at the ballot box. Now, it passed, so it is now in the Constitution. And I think really one of the questions that people ought to ask is not so much that whether you would repeal that amendment, because that's a really hard thing to do. You'd have to pass it, the bill twice in the General Assembly with an intervening election, an election in between, and then get it on the ballot, and then have the voters vote to repeal that amendment. So that is a very difficult thing to do. An interesting question, however, to ask your candidates is, would they favor a bill that would prohibit discrimination in the workplace based on sexuality? And that bill has been offered. That bill could be offered again. And that is a bill that potentially could come for a vote. That's the question you should ask. I'm in favor of prohibiting discrimination based on sexual orientation. And I hope other people will weigh in on that question as well.
I voted for the amendment to be put before the voters. The voters passed it, and it's in the Constitution. I do not support a repeal.
The issue, I think the question was, if we believed in same-sex marriages and would we change the Constitution? So I'm going to try to answer the question. I don't believe in same-sex marriages, and that comes from two things. One, I'm a member of the Christian faith. I think from my standpoint, it's a biblical belief. I also know from my biblical belief that all of us are sinners, at least that's my belief, myself included. And people make mistakes, and I don't judge people for whatever reason, whatever mistakes they make in life, and try to hold to that. Also, don't discriminate against individuals. It's not something that I would question or ask about from the standpoint of an employment standpoint, because I just don't think that's something we ask about when you're trying to hire somebody. But I wouldn't change the Constitution because the voters have spoken. They had two General Assembly sessions to say whether they agreed with the constitutional amendment that upholds that the marriage is between one man and one woman. And then they voted on that, and the majority across the Commonwealth did vote for that, and I did as well. So that's basically my position.
You know, I'm an individual who believes in the United States that in our democratic society, the way it was intended by our forefathers, is that we all can play by the fair game, by the same rules. I have supposedly the same rights and the same opportunity as Bill Gates to become a billionaire, or the same opportunity, the same generation through high school and college to become a professional baseball player if I had the talent. And I think that's what differentiates us from so many of these other countries in the world and despots, is the fact that we're supposed to not have any ceilings. And we are a country of great diversity. We would not be nearly as great today if it weren't for the diversity of all of our ancestors from all over the world. That's what makes us and has what has made us great. And I mentioned my five-year-old girl moments ago. Well, my five-year-old girl is deaf. And I want her to have the same opportunities going through education, going through in school, as a perfectly normal hearing child. And I don't, having said that, I do support hate crimes. I think it's unfortunate and a terrible way to treat a fellow human being, a fellow Christian, fellow member of any faith. But I don't have a problem with calling a marriage a union between a man and woman under God. But you know what? Even in the marriage sector, in the heterosexual community of which I am a member, you can go out to the Justice of the Peace and get married. That's not being done by a priest or a reverend or a pastor. That's a civil union. And our system, unfortunately, our tax system, is designed to benefit the folks who have those unions. And that's not fair to me. And when you have a monogamous same-sex civil union, let's say, and they've been together for 20, 30 years, one of them is terminally ill, and the other one cannot make any decisions based upon their behalf because they don't have that legal right. And I think that's atrocious. It's our system, I think, that has messed this up, and it's not fair. And therefore, I would support civil unions because I think that they should have the legal, justifiable, and medical right, the power of attorney, to experience the same rights that we all have.
Can I just... that Steve was saying, because I don't think anybody discriminates against somebody, you know, we don't discriminate when we hire people, but people need to understand one of the great things about our state is that it is a right to work state. But when you don't have the basic protections in this state, you can fire someone for no other reason than being gay. And that's what I think that the bill that David was talking about, you know, every company, if you look at the Fortune 500 companies, every company has subscribed to a set of non-discrimination policies, and they all include sexual orientation, gender identity, and expression. And those companies are fairly successful. They wouldn't be where they are. And so the fact that in 2009 we're still wondering whether it's okay to be inclusive in Virginia, I think is a problem. So, sorry.
Next question. What can be done to introduce an alternate source of cash crop from tobacco in Virginia? Yes.
The answer to that is to grow hemp. If... And as anybody here who's one of the interesting things, one of the things that I hope to make an issue of, and I hope people will bear with me because as this campaign goes on, my remarks should become more coherent. I'm fairly certain. But one of the issues is the United States, it's pretty commonly known, we're a nation of historical amnesiacs. But a lot of us are aware that Thomas Jefferson and George Washington grew hemp. And it was a common, ordinary, commercial, agricultural product until World War I, if I'm correct. And it has tremendous uses, and it's a tremendous resource. And it's a great ingredient in peppermint oil, Dr. Bronner's peppermint oil soap. That is, I'm going to pass that on. But if elected, I would reintroduce Mitch Vanieri's bill on, actually it was a study, if I'm correct. Could you help me, gentlemen? Wasn't this bill?
I don't think so.
Okay, well, I'll reintroduce it. Perhaps we can ask, I'll pass on here.
All right. Is this anybody's first such forum like this? Raise your hand if it's your first forum. Okay. Everybody else knows this, but it shouldn't, just so everybody knows. In every forum at some point, either the word hemp or legalization of marijuana, which are not the same thing, I'm not going to get into that debate, has to come up. And I think that the question was basically new uses for the new jobs for the farmers who are seeing their tobacco farms taken away. Obviously, the realization rate of a tobacco farm in terms of cash is higher. So one of the hard things is you can't just turn a 100-acre tobacco farm into a 100-acre soybeans farm and hope that you can survive or get by. So I think that the larger question would be jobs in the South Side. The Tobacco Settlement Fund, and I only know this because we had this sort of strange little UVA-related bill about it, you know, was a huge amount of money that was created as part of a settlement with the tobacco companies. And the deal was it was supposed to be used to help reinvent the economies of Southside Virginia, Kentucky, North Carolina, the places where they grow the tobacco. And the goal, I think, is twofold. First would be for those who still want to farm, you're going to have to consolidate the farms in some way so that you can still make a living at it. In addition, many farmers, of course, need a second job, and you have a bunch of farmers who are not going to be able to farm anymore. We need to have employment opportunities for them that are hopefully longer lasting than some of the jobs that have come to Southside, stayed for a few years, and then left. If we want them to stay in Martinsville, they've got to have a job that can stay there with them. Thank you.
Yeah.
Let me say that I don't think there will be a cash crop that replaces tobacco as we saw in the past history of the Commonwealth of Virginia. I just don't think in agriculture that's going to happen in the future. But there are some things that will help farmers, and especially in South Side. I also think it's not good for the farm community to be dependent on one cash crop. That's one of the reasons we've had problems, whether it can be also in the manufacturing area. If we're too dependent on one segment of the economy, whether it's agriculture or whatever, it's just not good for the economy. Diversification of any local economy is always the strongest thing to do. I do think you're going to see increase with, again, getting back to energy, but we're looking at biodiesel and some of those kinds of crops that are utilized that can be used as a fuel source. That's one area. One thing I'm very fond of that I've worked on very hard for Albemarle and Augusta County and the state is looking at wine production and vineyards. Vineyards are very good from the standpoint of the crop lasts, or the vines last a long time for the crop, 40 years. You make a big investment up front, and I don't know how many of you all are wine drinkers, but support Virginia Wine because they do an excellent job, and more importantly, it's a growing industry in Virginia and should be. Because even if you don't have a winery to make the wine, a lot of farmers are going and starting to grow grapes to help the wine industry in Virginia. I think those are two areas that we could really look at and see. Then the other thing I will think that we need to do is keep on the cutting edge of making sure that we're exporting those products from an agriculture standpoint that the rest of the world needs. We feed the rest of the world. The Commonwealth of Virginia is a very important part of that. And we need to make sure whether it's beef, whether it's some other kind of crop in the future, whether it's grapes or wine, we need to be on the cutting edge and continue to look for those sources for the farmers across the Commonwealth, because that's what's going to provide that replacement.
Steve, I don't know if Steve was going to say this, but I when I hear his answer, I think that it reminds us all that this all is tied together. This economy is tied together, and we have to put a lot of different pieces in place in order to get things done. You know, last session, I had a little bill. Anytime a legislator says, this nice little bill, be careful, because the opposition's coming for it. And that little bill was a bill that would have required truckers to have at least 2% of their fuel be biodiesel fuel by a certain year. It was designed to give them an opportunity to get ready for the change and also to help Virginia produce and manufacture the biodiesel so that they could fuel those trucks. The great thing about that bill is that we have manufacturers in Virginia who can produce it, and we have people who can produce the fuel that will go to the manufacturers who will produce the actual biodiesel. Well, it wasn't its time, so maybe next year it'll come back and we'll get it passed. But that being said, it all fits together, and the role of the Commonwealth is to put the policies in place and put the incentives in place that allow these transitions to occur so that the private sector can have those incentives to move forward. Right now, there's a huge debate about what's going to happen to the Port of Virginia. It's the best port on the East Coast, and there's a big debate about who's going to run it, whether it's going to be turned over to private hands, how that's going to work. But it has tremendous implications for the entire state. You don't think about it here because we don't live near the port, but it has huge implications. So we're going to have to watch that and monitor that very carefully so that we make sure that port is an operating port so we can feed the rest of the world with Virginia products that help Virginians have good jobs and a good quality of life.
My value add to that, because it's hard to disagree with what we've been hearing, but is really local food. I think we have a tremendous opportunity in Central Virginia for local food. I'm a new member of VICFA, and I don't know if anybody went to the Monticello High School event last Sunday, but it's amazing. These are small farms, and I think that's who, to me, we have to do everything possible to try to save our small farmers here. I mean, that's what makes this an incredible place. I'd like to be one, but I could never find my inner farmer. But, I mean, I so admire and respect them. And at VICFA and in other organizations, what they're trying to do is really match the demand for local food. We cannot, our farmers today cannot fulfill the demand for local food. And I think we have a tremendous opportunity there. And we need to do everything we can to try to, we're uniquely positioned to try to figure out how to have a sustainable food source. And it would be kind of exciting to try that, so.
We're running out of time, so Greg, I don't think you've addressed the issue.
Do you I can do it in 30 seconds. How's that?
Go right ahead.
Actually, I agree with Steve. I don't think there's going to be one cash crop that's going to come in here and do this. I think a big part of it to keep our quality of life, our way of life, our beautiful rolling hills is going to be diversify. My father-in-law farms about 1,000 acres, and he learned to do that a long, long time ago. He grows rice and soybeans, and he floods his fields, and he invites in during duck hunting season duck hunters to come in, and he makes a killing off these guys coming in and hunting ducks in his fields, and I think that's a wonderful idea to do. But ecotourism, I would love to see some of these farmers get into ecotourism. I mean, we have such one of the most beautiful parts of the country, and we're not tapping into this huge rising tourist movement, and that's tourist, not terrorist movement, for our rivers, our mountains, and our valleys.
One sentence. Yeah, hemp is, I think, an outstanding biofuel.
That was one sentence. Okay. We have a number of other wonderful questions, but we're running out of time, and we do want to give the candidates time to make their closing statements. So what I'm going to do to keep things fair is reverse the order from their opening statements. So again, we will start with the challenger. So Brandon, we'll start with you. You've got 2 minutes.
2 minutes. It's Robert Brandon Smith III, just to clarify. I go by both names, and anything works. RB works. RBS3 works. My concerns, I hope to elaborate. You can, if anybody throughout this campaign, I've started a little bit behind. I don't have any literature. I have a table over there. Put your name down. Rob Schilling has offered, if you go to his blog on his show, to carry my my information. So if you want some details. I'm in the process of writing up a platform that'll be, I'll have a short version and a longer version. I am concerned as someone who is, I've been something of an urban camper these past few years, basically homeless at one time. I think the city of Charlottesville and the churches do a marvelous job in taking care of the homeless and down and out and vulnerable people in this community. A lot more remains to be done. There's one public shelter that has a that is basically in this community, that's basically a snake pit, and that needs to be reformed. So there's a lot to be done. And I hope to address quite a few issues in addition to, hope your kids can hear me out there, no homework. What do I have left here? 30 seconds. I do want to repeat at the risk of repeating myself, as these things go on, I'll get the handle on this, and I'm going to enjoy it a lot more. And I came to this thing not quite with the written stuff in hand. And next time I'm confident that I'll be more on the ball. But I enjoyed it very, very much. Enjoyed listening to my opponent and the other candidates.
Thank you. David.
Thank you very much for the opportunity to participate today. I really had a good time. I hope you enjoyed it too. It was good to hear the questions to give some sense of what's on people's minds. We didn't hear your perspective on those issues. So if you do have perspectives that we need to be aware of, please call me. I'm the only Toscano in the book. I'm easy to find. I've got a website. You can post something to the website. I mean, on Facebook, you can go there. Because frankly, you know, the challenges that we face are so immense that one individual mind is not going to be up to the task. 100 members of the House of Delegates are not going to be up to the task. We need all of you in the room helping us with your perspective. And please don't just participate during this electoral season. Say what you will about all the healthcare debate going on. One of the wonderful things about it is that people are really engaged in that debate, and it's not just about the election. So I hope that as we go through the campaign, you'll feel free to give me a call and let me know what's going on. I hope that you'll feel free to volunteer, take some literature, tell your friends that there is an election, it's an important election. The governor's race is open, too, and we've got some candidates there that deserve your close scrutiny. So I appreciate the opportunity and look forward to speaking with you. And by all means, I ask for your support. I need your support. I need your vote on November 3rd or whenever it is. Thank you.
Greg.
You really have to end this. I've got to go home to a wife who thinks I'm married to somebody named Cindy now. So. Folks, you know, Einstein once said, intelligent people fix problems. Geniuses prevent them. And I certainly am not a genius, but I do think that our career politicians have got to stop thinking to the next election and got to be thinking 10, 20, 30 years down the road. They need to be thinking into, to paraphrase Brandon with the Iroquois quote, the seventh generation, you need to be start thinking about the impact our decisions make now, that we make now, on those generations 4, 5, 6, and 7 down there. That's what's going to keep us as a human race still plugging away in the United States, the best country in the world. You know, he also said, Einstein also said, and I'm paraphrasing here a little bit here, is that the minds that got us in this mess can't be expected to know how to get us out of them. And that's where I think my fresh blood, my new energy, my experience in medicine, my experience as a successful business owner, veterans issues, marine biology, education. I think that's what I bring to the table. I think that we've just gotten very, very complacent in Richmond. We've got a lot of problems here, not only the ones we've talked about today, but we've got education, we've got transportation and things like that. And I think we would not be having a ailing, failing, crumbling infrastructure and transportation if our politicians 10 years ago had thought that this might happen a decade from now. And if they were making decisions that would have been concerned about that right now. You fund transportation, then you fix the problem. You don't get us into a situation where all of a sudden now we're closing rest areas. So I just think that it's time that we have some fresh energy that goes in there, goes to Richmond, wants to do something. I have no interest in being a career politician. I enjoy what I do now. But I do like to make change. I do care about my community, as every one of us up here do, and everyone who's ever served in the political arena do. I just think that it's time to fight the system a little bit, because I do think that the system corrupts. I think that the people who go to Richmond are good people at heart, every one of them. But I think we've become so polarized that we get nothing done. And I do bridge that gap. I have a lot of conservative issues. I've worked on conservative campaigns. And if I get elected and the Democratic Party thinks that I'm just going to roll over and because I'm the freshman, the new kid on the block, they got a lot of things coming because I vote for the conservative issues of our district and of our valley. Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Well, let me first thank the senior statesmen for, again, having us. This is always a great event, and I appreciate their willingness to host this and really put it on, and the Senior Center, obviously, for allowing us the space and the area to have this public forum. I also want to thank all the other candidates up here, all the folks that are running. My experience has been anybody that's willing to run for public office, first, you probably ought to have their head examined. But that aside, after having done this for 13 years, I do appreciate their willingness to put themselves out there and to put their ideas out there. And I think they all should be congratulated for that, because it's not an easy job, as has been mentioned. And running for office is not an easy thing. One of the things I've tried to do over the last 13 years is listen to constituents. One of the things that I've always learned is you can have an idea, but when you're a representative, you first have to listen to what are people's concerns? What would they like to see you do? And then I've tried to do that.
My mentor, my predecessor, Pete Giesen, was quoted one time as a colleague describing him as a workhorse, not a show horse. And I've tried to emulate that. I've tried to work hard in the legislature. I've tried to represent the views of the people that elected me each and every time. And I've also found that no elected official I've ever known have I agreed with 100% of the time. There's probably something wrong if you do agree with them 100% of the time. But if they listen and then they try to implement what you, the people, request, I think we can't ask much more of them. If you're in the 25th House District, I want to ask for your vote. Sometimes elected officials forget to do that. And as David said, I think it's incumbent upon us to ask you. If you live in the 25th District, first important is vote. But if you can see your way to support me, I'd very much appreciate that and would be honored. The last thing I want to say is these jobs are important. Being in the legislature is not a full-time job. It's a part-time job. But experience is important. Experience in knowing how the process works and getting things done. I've tried to do that in Richmond. I served as a legislative aide to my predecessor. I've been in the legislature now for 13 years. And I think experience is important. And experience is important because it also demonstrates you've been able to provide leadership. And I think I've demonstrated that with the number of issues that I mentioned and the things I want to work on for the future. And none of us do this for our own gain. I mean, it's all about serving the public, as I mentioned earlier, and that's what we should be about. And again, I just want to thank the senior statesman for having this, and thank you all for being here and being an attentive audience. No one fell asleep, and that's a good sign.
So first, I'd like to just, you know, echo what everybody else has said. It really is an honor to be here, and the fact that everybody comes out in the middle of the day to listen to this, and I know no one fell asleep, but there were a couple people I could see kind of going, oh my, this is going on a while. And so to sit here and come and listen to us, I think, is really a tremendous honor. I have tremendous respect for the three folks to my right. You know, it is a hard job being a legislator. It is a very hard job being a candidate, I can tell you. I have always worked hard my whole life. I've taken care of myself from the time I was 17. And I have to say, this ranks right up there with the tough things I've ever done. You really do put yourself out there. You worry about what people are going to say about you. When somebody rolls their eyes while you're talking, your heart sinks a little bit. It's like, am I that bad? You know, but it's also, it takes way too much money and way too much time. We could fix this. There has to be a better way to run elections and to get people into office. But I would tell you, I really do feel very strongly, as much as I admire the gentleman to my right, I think that what I bring to the table is unique. I think that government should run more like a business and less like a bureaucracy. I am used to being held accountable. Even after 25 years, you know, I worked as hard the last year as I did the first, and I received IBM's highest appraisal in my last year of work. I'm used to being paid for performance. I'm used to being threatened with my job if I didn't accomplish. I'm used to dealing with budgets that shrink and objectives that grow. And I think that's what we're facing here in Virginia now. You know, we have a transportation system that's going to make it tricky for us to attract businesses here when they're not sure they can get their goods to market or their employees to work. I think that, you know, we've received an F in college affordability. One out of five of our high school students doesn't make it out. We need universal pre-K. Only 30% of our kids are eligible to go to preschool. And we know that makes a difference, especially in those kids like my CASA kids that need a chance. And so I just think that I have to say, I was just going to close and say, I have to make a pitch for the $125 million in federal stimulus money for unemployment. I was so personally disheartened. I have fought unemployment claims in business for somebody that was trying to get it and shouldn't. But these were people who've lost their jobs. We should have helped them out with unemployment. Thank you very much. I would love your votes.
Okay, so I guess I get to do the final closing. I want to say one more time, thank you for coming out. The truth is, if you're in this room, you're in the most engaged, thoughtful 1% of 1% of people in our community. And I'll tell you a little story. It was, I guess, 2 years ago we had a similar event at State Farm, and it was more of a question and answer. It was a smaller group, so we could engage more directly. And one of the ladies came up with part of what ultimately became the Virginia Tech fix. And I would agree what the gentleman said about none of us up here are geniuses, but collectively we are. And she just said, look, I'm a mother. If I'd been Cho's mother and if I'd known what would happen, I'd have gone right down, you know, and brought him home and fixed it. None of us thought of that. That was the bill. That became part of the fix. We said we're going to give parents some additional information. Now, it was a much harder fight than that than you would think. The mental health groups were concerned that if you make it too big, perhaps the kids won't go to mental health if they think their parents are going to see it. So we had to balance all of these issues. But you all coming out and engaging and helping us come up with legislation is what makes Virginia run better and makes it a better place. And I know many of you have come, some of you even received them, but I do these Citizen Lawmaker Awards every year, and all it is recognizing the person whose idea it was, which is you all. So thank you for taking the time out of your days to engage, get better informed, and hopefully give us some answers to some of the questions we have. The second is I do want to thank all the other people standing up, or sitting up here on the podium, and especially the three challengers. This is a hard endeavor. This was a very civil debate. I think we were all able to disagree without being disagreeable. You don't see that every time. And I was at my son's, so my training for this last night was Robbie's kindergarten orientation with 80 other parents and 80 kindergartners and their younger siblings. And this was nothing like that. This was much better. So thank you for the civil debate up here on the podium. Thank you for coming out today. And I appreciate your vote if you choose to give it to me in November. Thank you very much.
Going to take one more minute of your time, mostly to thank our esteemed guests for their time and most importantly their commitment to us, John and JQ Public. Win or lose, each candidate has absolutely demonstrated and proven their steadfastness and devotion in trying to meet the needs of people in our community. I thank you all, and I thank all of you for coming, for your attention, for your questions, for your support of senior statesmen, and for dealing with the cold. This concludes our forum, and we'll see you next year.
For the Charlottesville Podcasting Network, I'm Dan Daniels.